Welcome to The Deep End by On Deck, a podcast where visionary builders, creators, and experts discuss world-changing ideas. I'm your host, Marshall Kozlov. Let's dive in.
It's really difficult for a normal user to actually price how much their data is worth, nor do they care, because, you know, most of the time, I mean, I think from emotional level, they definitely care. They don't want companies to invade on their privacy, but they kind of are aware that they're exchanging something for something else because there's no free lunch. They're like, okay, I'm getting ads, and that's how they make money. But in reality, it has to be much more complex than that, right? It's much more than selling ads. There are things, you know, that go behind these platforms that users are actually not aware of, and that companies obscure away.
The Deep End. We're creating a space where we skip the surface level and go in depth into ideas that inspire people to build. I'll be your guide as we explore possible futures of internet communities, creator tools, climate tech, longevity, and much, much more. There are no experts in uncharted territory, only pioneers. The Deep End invites these trailblazers to turn their experiences into the knowledge and ideas that others need to start their own founder odysseys. Joining me this week in The Deep End is Tina He. Tina is an investor with Pace Capital and is also on the founding team at Station, which builds itself as building the rails for Web3. Her work with Pace and Station has helped her identify the myriad mental shifts that builders need to make when migrating from Web2 to Web3. Today's conversation is about those mental shifts. For example, the legal infrastructure that exists today has not caught up to technology's most recent community organizing abilities. As DAOs gain more credibility and sophistication, there also need to be clearer distinctions between companies and communities. Contracts will look different too, raising questions like, will employees and 1099 contractors have the same kind of benefits as community contributors? Tina also breaks down the human-centric ideologies of Web3. The most talented builders are asking how we might redistribute value to the long tail, as opposed to the fang behemoths who own so much of the overall value in Web2. Language we use in Web3 moving forward matters. The conversation with Tina helps us understand what some of these guiding rails can be. Tina He, welcome to The Deep End.
Thanks for having me.
I'm really excited to talk with you, Tina, not only because of your background in Web2 spaces company-wise, but also the fact that you are an entrepreneur in residence at Pace Capital, but you're also building a community and a network. I want to actually start there. When we were talking before the episode, you specifically said, I'm not really building a company with Station. You're building something else, which, considering you're an entrepreneur in residence, that's a framework which is going to sound new to a lot of people based on how things have typically seemed to have worked in Silicon Valley, on the internet, et cetera. So it would be great for you to introduce Station through the context of what you're doing today.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk to you more about Station. I can talk about Station all day, obviously. The reason why I think there's a delineation between company and community is, you know, traditional company is, you know, this legal entity, which we still will be, because, you know, we're the world hasn't caught up, the legal infrastructure has not caught up with the world of Web3. So we have to, you know, kind of accommodate what currently is there. But the biggest difference is that Web3 organizations and communities are a lot more amorphous, and a lot more borderless than a company. What that means is that, you know, for a company, you usually have this W-2 form and, you know, you're formally employed or you're a 1099 worker working for this company. There's this formal contract, you know, that establishes the relationship between an employer and employee in crypto communities. And, you know, recently people are talking about DAOs a lot. A lot of these relationships, right, are actually established through legal contracts, and people can talk about, like, you know, tax issues, payroll taxes, and actually you can also, you know, add logic around payroll taxes just on top of your payment. So in many ways, you know, one can still be a member of community without, you know, formally employed and getting paid in tokens either through their community's native tokens or through a cryptocurrency like Ethereum or, you know, other, I guess, very popular is like stablecoin as well, like USDC, you know, as their salary. And people have a lot more flexibility because without this legal contract, they can kind of work at many different organizations all at once. And we usually, you know, see on Twitter that these people call themselves contributors because as the name suggests, they really are just contributing to many communities simultaneously. That's kind of the community that we're trying to build, is that, you know, we recognize that there's so many great contributors that have transitioned from, you know, former either finance jobs, Web2 jobs, you know, really, really smart, capable people that really, really get attracted to this ideology of decentralized technology, decentralized organizations, because, you know, there's no central point of failure or authority. You know, everyone is actually open to explore what they want to do within the organization because, you know, people are multifaceted. Right now, you know, according to LinkedIn, according to our resume, we're kind of boxed in into this one job title when, you know, a lot of people I know that are brilliant encapsulates, you know, many job titles. You know, they're writers, they're creators, they're, you know, they can also be a product manager, they can be a software engineer. There's just like, you know, many, many different roles that are emerging in these communities that traditionally did not exist. But there's really no network and ways to discover, you know, contributors, especially in crypto, you know, given the organizational structure that's a little bit different from traditional companies. And that's why I've been really kind of mindful about calling it not a company, but a community, because it is, you know, a lot more amorphous that way. And we recognize that, you know, in order to actually coordinate contributors, it's going to be requires a different set of tools and a different side of mindset than, you know, Web2 companies. So Web2 companies, you know, give birth to a wave of SaaS companies, you know, all the way from Workday, the Gen 1, Gen 2 SaaS companies, to Salesforce, to, you know, Gusto, and now like the modern software that empowers, you know, the whole HR stack, to productivity tools like Asana, Trello, Atlassian, and, you know, other human coordination tools need to evolve because now people belong to so many organizations while, you know, their reputation and data actually it's interoperable across all these organizations, but there's no way to actually aggregate these data of contribution. So one tangible example is that, let's say I'm actually a proud investor and also a member of FWB, Friends with Benefits, and, you know, being a part of that community, I'm also a part of Station, you know, the community that we're currently building right now. And there's no way for me to, you know, have two sets of reputation, you know, or one set of reputation being a crew from both communities. So every time I join a new community, I have to like kind of start from the ground up. And there's no way to really show that, you know, I'm someone who's an active participant in, you know, the network. And within this network, there's like these organizations that I'm a part of. So really what Station's building, there's twofold. One is the network, as you mentioned, and the community part. So we want to really attract and bring together the best contributors we know, first in crypto and later, you know, from all places, and people who want to transition into Web3. And there's this network piece, and there's another piece that's infrastructure and tooling. So in order to actually, you know, onboard them, you know, assign them to different projects to work on, paying them, you know, having them pay each other, like all these tooling actually right now are still very nascent. So we believe that, you know, we can, you know, take a stab at building these tools ourselves. And a lot of people actually are attracted to our network because they are builders themselves that want to build these tools. So there's also this dynamics around, like, we build the infrastructure first, we attract the people, and the people come, you know, for the tools, for the technology, and then they actually stay for the culture, for the network, because it's just a community of contributors and builders. Yeah, so that's what Station is.
So a lot of great things that I want to pick up there. In no particular order, we talked about before, this is going to go a bunch of different places, but I think that's why people tend to enjoy anything Web3 related. You talked about the ideology of decentralization in these spaces. Could you expand on what that means? Because at this stage, I've noticed that's what seems to attract a lot of people to the space versus X, Y, and Z, very specific thing. So I'd love to hear you talk more about the ideology of the space you're in.
I think there's like different schools of thought within even Web3, but it's pretty encouraging that I think this, the latest wave of Web3, is probably the most human-centric that I've seen. in a way that people are actively having a lot of discussions about, you know, human coordination, like social tokens, communities, token gated access to different groups, you know, different even IRL events, media companies, you know, traditional institutions, cultural institutions like Christie's, right? Like with the whole NFT boom, like people are actively thinking about, you know, how to apply the technology to solve human problems. And that is actually, you know, one of the things that I guess that the most prominent ideology that comes out from this wave of crypto. There's previous waves of crypto that have might have different prominent narrative, but specifically for this one, I think a lot of it is around, you know, redistributing value and ownership to the little people, like to the long tail. And little people here means like it's easy to come across as like maybe condescending, but it's not. It just means that it's anybody who's not an institution. So users, individual users, right, is, you know, very little and has that doesn't have that much control compared to, let's say, an investor in a company that usually owns, you know, a meaningful share of a company and therefore has more governance power and more say in the direction of where the company should go. And in addition to that, you know, most of the revenue, most of the value being accrued to platforms, you know, this is a very, very popular argument now. Probably everybody who is on a Web3 podcast talks about Facebook, Google, and how they accrue all these value and, you know, how Web3 is potential, you know, a different way to redistribute them. And actually, the I think that the theories or the theoretical approach of, you know, these ideologies has been relatively well understood, especially for people in tech, and slowly becomes well understood for people outside of tech as well, right? It's people kind of start to understand, oh, I can get paid for the data I generate. I can actually, you know, own a piece of business that I help enable. And I think it's slowly start to penetrate, but I think we're still, you know, really, really far, to be honest, from just a product experience perspective to really get there with the existing constraint. But back to your question about ideologies, I think it's really about redistributing value, like, and ownership, and makes, you know, people share the upside of whatever activities, organizations they're a part of.
Something you just said was, you referred to this as a different phase of the overall development of the crypto space. When did you first get into crypto?
I actually got into crypto pretty late compared to most people working in crypto right now, which I think actually offer me a pretty different perspective where I'm a little bit more practical and actually, you know, believe so much and actually admire the ideology so much without, I think, being too dogmatic about it. It's very obvious that there has been school of thought that has been formed, like, for example, like Bitcoin maximalist or some other schools of thought that have been formed that, you know, have very strong opinion about approaching a certain type of, let's say, community building or the way they raise capital and the way that they distribute their tokens. But I think, right, like coming from Web2, so I personally have a Web2 background and have been an investor actually in the Web2 space for a long time. What I care a lot more about is actually the mechanics and the actual experience, user experience of how to enable value to actually be redistributed, because there needs to be value in the first place to be redistributed before even designing very intricate mechanisms and protocols. And that's why I think it actually gives somewhat of an edge to come in late. So back to your question about how when I got into crypto, probably like early last year was when I started, you know, helping set up some of these communities, you know, to really start like applying crypto as a technology, but intellectually has been following it for a while, but didn't really act upon it.
What's interesting about that is, as you said, this was last year. We all had a lot of times to think about these things. What in the Web2 space excited you before crypto or still excites you today?
Actually, I love a lot of Web2 companies. So back when I was a Web2 investor, I focused a lot on bottoms-up movement. And like very obviously, like bottoms-up movement is all that Web3 is about. So, you know, back in Web2, like I studied, you know, product-led growth as just this thesis at large, pretty extensively. So product-led growth is like this, now is pretty buzzwordy, but what it means is just like the product is so great that the community of the product will just talk about it. So, you know, rather than the company as a centralized authority, you know, spend tons on SMN, like sales and marketing, and like, you know, create these giant campaigns, users actually are the most effective advocates, you know, that are one example, like many examples. But one example of that is like Figma, which is this design software. And if you go on YouTube and look at Figma, there's like, you know, tons of tutorials being created. And these YouTubers usually don't get paid doing that because they just love the tool so much and it's really fun. And the other example is Notion, another example of like a productivity software that, you know, created this global phenomena of, you know, Notion enthusiasts that would, you know, organize local meetups, would, you know, create tutorials and create all the value, all the enterprise values for these companies, but without actually ever getting paid. And they're just volunteers. So that's actually a more commercial example of, you know, one category of Web2 companies that I personally really, really am fascinated by, because, you know, there's always this kind of level of value leakage that I think about where, you know, these users or these passionate, power users are creating so much value for the company by tweeting about it, you know, talking about it, creating content for it. Why are they not, you know, getting the upside of the company's success? And if they are, right, they will be more incentivized to, you know, almost, you know, can run their own like mini operations of, you know, their own affiliate program for this piece of software. And in that sense, you know, there can be additional ways to generate revenue based on, you know, even like a franchise model than, you know, traditional kind of just enterprise tier pricing that could even maybe make the network effect even bigger. They didn't take that route, so we wouldn't know. And it was very, very difficult to pull that off, right, without the kind of crypto infrastructure to divide equity in a way that's very easy. So that's kind of one thesis area that I focus pretty broadly on. And the other is actually, you know, open source software, which again, follows a lot of the similarities with crypto. So it's, yeah, basically similar idea of everything that I just talked about, but it's just developers, right? And there's literally now developer tools being built just to run developer communities. Actually at Pace, we invested in this company called Discourse, which now basically powers the community or forum discussions of all the crypto protocols and also like a lot of developer forums for like, let's say Twitter, Figma, I think they all use Discourse to host their community, for them to answer their own question, which saves costs from, you know, customer support perspective and also, you know, increases brand awareness, community loyalty and all that good stuff. So all similar logic that things I've been thinking again and again and again. And I was like, there's so much value leakage, right? And crypto just ended up becoming this, you know, one kind of, when it clicks, it just, I just cannot look back. It's just a much more elegant incentive alignment from like between users and companies and products.
You know, I'm so glad you gave the answer that way, because as you just stated, your interest in Web2 built to Web3. And if you're really thinking of what you're building with Station, it's the logical conclusion of the phenomenon that you were so interested in. So it's good to see that these aren't just pure vibes driven pivots, which I think is the concern when most people are looking at this very complicated space from the outside. Here's something I'm curious about. So something you've done very effectively here, and I think this is what's driving a lot of the early interest in Web3, is you've described how employees or people who are creating, generating value, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you've described how they can benefit, or they have this specific set of problems, aka not getting fairly rewarded, compensated from the work they put into Web2 platforms. Let's talk about users, and not creator users, not people who are trying to make money, but just the everyday actual person who wakes up, doesn't think of the word Web 1, doesn't think of Web 2, just thinks of the internet as just being the internet. My concern is in these conversations, and this is probably what leads to the inaccessibility argument you're seeing people start to put forward, there's just this lack of engagement with how everyday people who aren't even concerned about or even approaching this from an equity perspective are thinking about it. So where do you think the actual users and consumers of tech products in this Web 2 to Web 3 transition, where do they fit into the discussion or even just your mental framework?
I think, okay, so I think there's like a history here where I think in the beginning, like, let's say a user, you know, all the users, you know, are very used to this free-to-play dynamics of Web2 companies where, you know, they kind of are aware that they're making money on ads, but the actual, like, mechanism through which that revenue is generated is very obscure, right? You're like, oh, they're selling my data for ads, or, you know, Web2 companies are, you know, a lot of Web2 companies' business model is really just around kind of, you know, gating data assets. And it's really difficult for a normal user to actually price how much their data is worth, nor do they care, because, you know, most of the time, I mean, I think from emotional level, they definitely care. They don't want companies to invade on their privacy, but they kind of are aware that they're exchanging something for something else because there's no free lunch. They're like, okay, I'm going to get ads, and that's how they make money. But in reality, it has to be much more complex than that, right? It's much more than selling ads. There are things, you know, that go behind these platforms that users are actually not aware of, and that companies obscure away. And there's this argument around, like, how much are you willing to pay for the entertainment or the utility that you're getting? And there's always a fair exchange until it breaks. And I think recently we're seeing that users are starting to realize that the trade is not equal. So they're basically, you know, selling their data for basically exchanging the value that they're creating too cheaply. Or the value exchange is, you know, not equal in terms of the actual value generated by these companies because of the immense wealth and growth that we already see even during COVID. You know, the best tech companies are growing even faster. And we see how the economy is literally, like, the small businesses literally depend on, you know, ads and the entire advertising, you know, business from Google and Facebook. And I think a lot of these realities start to collapse, and it kind of encourages people to really examine more deeply, you know, on how much their labor is cost, you know, for these platforms. And yeah, I think it's actually a combination of many, many forces at play that led to a moment of, I guess, like, cultural awakening into social media or, you know, just all these Web2 platform, you know, around this narrative of, like, ownership that previously was, you know, a lot more around, you know, addiction or mental health or other critiques. But this time is, like, really financial, which I find very, very interesting. And, you know, given also the rise of crypto, you know, in the past year, I think the two forces combined made people just hyper aware of, you know, how as consumers, they're actually, you know, looking for more. And I think there's, you know, two different, I guess, large school of thought here in within kind of the consumer mindset. Like, one is that, like, okay, I just want privacy. I don't want to interact with any consumer products. I kind of just want to, you know, do my own thing and not engage in this activity at all. And the other is, like, okay, like, I would rather contribute to something that would compensate me fairly when they offer the same product and services. And that is also an outcome of, you know, these product and services being more commoditized because software is becoming cheaper to build. And that is why, you know, it's so much easier to clone a Facebook now than, let's say, when Facebook just got started. And, you know, different communities in the future very likely will create their own vertical, like, software stack to fill their own needs. And users can just pick, you know, whichever give them the most incentive. You know, that can be financial, that can be social capital, that can be other form of incentive that, you know, they can have more optionality to pick, like, which software stack they want to use.
So something that I want to go back to is you were describing the gap between the legal infrastructure and the more hypothetical parts of the world and space we're describing here. So can you speak more about the specifics of where there's work and attention to be done and how the lack of work and attention there limits taking all of this to its logical conclusion in a useful way?
To be quite honest, I think it's going to take a long time. Maybe I'm really wrong because I think no one really knows crypto law that well these days. I think there's a few lawyers that have been really, really sharp around understanding potentially how, you know, token economics and like, as we mentioned, like, these employer-employee relationship will unfold in the future, but just based on kind of the existing legal infrastructure. But honestly, like, the ability to catch up is you know, pretty weak. I mean, just even look at JustWorks, right? Like what JustWorks does is that it hires all the, it puts all the employees on paper as W employees. So like when I, although I worked, let's say for Pace Capital, and then they pay me, and then on my payroll, it shows JustWorks. So they own all the paperwork. And actually that's how a lot of these remote work employment companies work. So they're called employee of record. And they go around different countries and they become employee of record of that country. And they have to probably partner with some staffing agency that already had that legal framework, you know, established. And there's probably some level of revenue share there, incentive sharing there. And then that agency actually employ all these employees, and then they just build the software on top of that. So that's kind of like how the existing, like even SaaS companies work in Web 2. And like Web 3 is even a step further than that. Like I think very realistically, like in order to hire somebody as a actual legitimate, let's say, employee, and they actually want the benefit of being an employee to have access to maybe like, you know, benefits or other benefits that they want to have access to in their respective country, probably like we need to create legal wrapper around that. So either we need to like partner with some existing agency that have that compliance, you know, already executed, and then we partner with them, and then we execute, you know, all the payment terms, and then, you know, generate a legal document using a software, and then process them, which is actually not that different from, I think, a lot of how Web2 companies get around it. But in Web3, it's a little bit more nuanced, because right now, you know, in Web2, we still use one currency. And in Web3, I think, you know, the proliferation of, you know, the different types of payment as we all know it might even overcomplicate things a little bit more. But I can foresee how maybe more standard stablecoin, which potentially could also get regulated, especially in the United States, like something like a USDC, you know, could be popular outside of the US. That's as far as I know about how kind of this legal part will unfold in the foreseeable future. But of course, like we'll love innovative, you know, collaborative, you know, entrepreneurs and lawyers to really step up and kind of think about these issues more critically. But because crypto is such a global phenomena where everyone's part of it, it's actually extremely difficult to regulate, like from on a national level. So yeah.
Something I'm wondering about then is if you're looking at previous, and once again, when we say previous crypto eras, those eras are still going on. The timeline isn't actually that long here. A serious problem when it's come to the broader regulatory picture, like whether it's in the US or in China, the European Union, is that the stories and language that people tell around the space play a large role in helping like established legacy players like determine whether this is a good thing or a bad thing, whether they should be open to something or closed to something. But given what you just said, this is such a literally globalized and frankly asynchronous movement. How exactly will these stories be told properly or even told at all? For example, there's no, at least right now, there's no Web3 equivalent of Brian Armstrong testifying for the US Congress. So just how do you just think about how that plays, not how it literally plays out, but how legacy institutions and players with quite large abilities through regulation to impact a space, how do you think they should think about the nature of how these are really communities and not top down?
So one inspiring movement is actually from this community. I think there's a few. There's one called LexDAO, which and there's one called like Lex Army, which is, you know, adjacent to the Yearn community, Yearn Finance community. And there's a bunch of like kind of Yearn users who are also passionate community members of Yearn, which is a completely decentralized, like fully like pseudonymous contributor core team that, you know, create like this decentralized yield aggregation, like vaults, and people can, you know, put their money in, and there are strategists on the other side optimizing yield across different yield farms. So it's just a very crypto native protocol. But the interesting thing about that is that they've built such a strong community because of the culture they've built around like pseudonymity and bottoms up movement, that actually a bunch of really smart lawyers that previously might have, you know, prestigious lawyer jobs at different variety of places, you know, started to form DAO among themselves you know, it's almost like unionizing themselves to like, it's really cool to you know, talk about these issues pseudonymously. I know that, you know, I saw that you guys also like interview Board Elon, which is a pseudonymous account. So we're really, really bullish, honestly, on pseudonymous economy, especially when, you know, there's some level of accountability, which, you know, either zero knowledge proof and some other encryption solution could solve, which is, you know, verifying their identity to make sure that, you know, if they do something illegal or something really bad, you know, they're held accountable, but at the same time preserving their privacy, which is actually super, super hard to do these days. But I can foresee that becoming more prominent. And you know, these lawyers are also pseudonymous creating these proposals and reading legal documents and, you know, are trying to gather or kind of, you know, mobilize resources. And to be honest, they're kind of potential LPs, right, to support what they're doing is almost like also global. And to be quite frankly, like pretty infinite. It's like anybody who wants crypto to exist will want to support these guys. And, you know, there's probably going to be more groups like that to exist. To answer your question, like I don't think, you know, anybody can see the future precisely, but it's almost like a logical conclusion that it's very likely, given the infrastructure and also like existing phenomena that's already happening, that around the world you can see these like bottoms up grassroots, like unions of, you know, lawyers or legal people that are like kind of more knowledgeable in this space would you know, step up and start drafting documents that could be impactful. And on the other side of that, right, it still requires, you know, top-down institutions, people with actual legitimacy and have like executive power within governments and within, you know, organizations to, you know, take these proposals and act on it. Because without that executive power, it's very hard to move things forward. And I think it's very likely that the people that will be executing these proposals would be pretty like global. And it's similar with like how the Estonian government is much more forward thinking about, you know, integrating crypto in their citizens' life. And I think Taiwan as well is pretty forward thinking in that sense. But it's really, you know, up to the leadership as well, how you know, how open minded they are.
That's actually a good pivot to the reputation part of all of this, which you referenced. But firstly, what do you just think about the, because once again, we're building off of our Board Elon Musk episode. What do you think about the pseudonymous phenomenon? Have you ever thought about, you know, dropping the Twitter and taking things a different direction? Or how do you just think about it for yourself personally, but then broadly speaking, just at a phenomenon level?
Yeah, that's a great question. So something that really trips my friend up and the people who know me is that I'm actually Chinese. I came here when I was 14 for education. I have been here like since then. And like Tina is actually like my nickname. So like my legal name is actually not Tina. And Tina actually doesn't appear on any of my legal documents. And like back then, it was a very harmless decision because I just thought, right, people didn't know how to pronounce my Chinese name. And it's like kind of a pain to explain it every time. So Christina was like the name that my godmother gave me when I was born. She's like a mentor of my dad. And I ended up just picking Tina because it's easy. And right now I actually feel like, wow, everything's coming full circle because yeah, like I only use my nickname and it's actually pretty difficult unless, you know, people have really direct relationship with me to know what my real name is. And that's like one level of security, I guess. But I mean, if you really want to find out, you still can. But that's
it's not, exactly. don't chat. Podcast listeners are weird. Don't challenge people.
Yes, exactly. You can probably find out, but like, I think that goes to the second point is that I think most people are extremely terrible at remaining pseudonymous. And it's actually very, very difficult to be pseudonymous. I think in that sense, I just wouldn't mind doxing myself. But in the future, if I want to actually create an alternative identity, I need to do that professionally and actually ask people how to do it. But right now, I feel like performatively, I almost like didn't want to do it by like just slapping like a, you know, ape on my profile picture and everyone kind of knows who I am. I don't think that's like true pseudonymity. But kind of, you know, around my actual circles and, you know, in DAOs, I'm referred as Fake Pixels. And I usually tell people I'm Tina, but I think that's all there is. Yeah.
I think what you just said is so funny because it speaks to how I felt about talking to Bordy Wan when I was like, man, that would be cool. But I just kind of realized if I did do it, I would do a shitty job of doing it. So I would do something. But if I ever said anything actually worth saying, it'd be very quickly discoverable. So yeah, I think the advice that I will take from what you just said is if you actually want to do this, do it seriously and consider the parts there. But look, the thing the pseudonymous part builds on is this idea of what you discussed earlier in the podcast about how in these communities, reputation is actually everything. And in a world where your actual reputation is driving your value, rank, etc., your actual literal name, where you went to school, even your nationality is going to be less important. So can you just talk about reputation? Because if you're thinking about this, I'm thinking of this episode, especially given what you're doing at Station, as being just a general guide to people thinking about onboarding onto the Web3 space, train or not. And there are a bunch of mental shifts people are going to have to make going from Web2 to Web3, just as if you're working on Wall Street and you're going to go work at a tech company, there are some actually big mental shifts there too. So can you just talk about that whole broad idea of reconceiving of what your reputation is, what that means, and the broader implications for people who are looking at Station and are looking at getting into this space?
No, totally. I think you actually summarized the thesis really, really well. It is like very, you know, simply put, it's that, you know, your credentials, you know, what is credential? Like credential was just another reputation protocol that, you know, previous people, like previous generation established to make things easier. And, you know, over time, it's just, you know, the law of entropy where, you know, some of the laws or some of the guidance or some of the guardrails become, you know, less effective as an indicator of someone's legitimacy. And, you know, in the future, I would actually imagine, you know, right now, what is legitimate in crypto could also deteriorate over time. But, you know, regardless of what that reality is, the actual thing that matters is that we need new protocol to capture data that actually reflect in higher fidelity someone's competency. And that is why we need to build something from the ground up again, because, you know, as you mentioned, right, like reputation is such a core part of the mindset shift that happens, you know, with waves of technological, like kind of innovation or cultural zeitgeist change. And, you know, back in Wall Street, your reputation is very likely who you know. I guess that's also similar with Silicon Valley, but in Wall Street, it's who you know, and like, you know, whether you're, you know, in New York, geographic, like, you know, location also matter, which is still also the same with I guess, tech industry. But I think there's also differences, nuance, right? Like tech industry compared to like, you know, high finance is slightly more democratized. Like there are a lot more, you know, immigrants, there are a lot more, you know, people of color or just people that, you know, didn't go to a fancy Ivy League school who work in tech. So definitely it's a, you know, if you look at it from an absolute basis, like tech has so many problems that we don't have to go into right now, but definitely an improvement. And I think with crypto, like similarly, you know, some problems would still persist. And that's just, I think that's just like, you know, when you're already really successful and established and you're playing the game of compounding in terms of wealth and reputation and social network, I think it's kind of unavoidable that, you know, you also have a leg up when it comes to crypto. You get more information, you get access to, you know, high quality source of information. But, you know, people who can really master the information game, and very encouragingly, we see teenagers like Rory Capital, guys at Rory Capital, and there's this like 13-year-old kid that's, I'm blanking out his name. He's like, I think his name's Gotch. And then his like cover photo is like Godfather or something like that. He's like a 13-year-old like protocol founder. And I was like pretty inspired, honestly. And then he has this like very self-deprecating humor that I'm just like, is his like parents running his account? Like this kid is way too self-aware to be a 13-year-old. But you just see these like really cool, you know, kind of young people leveraging, you know, the power of information and also code, right, very frankly, to be able to kind of, you know, win in this new game of crypto. So back to your point about like, you know, Station and our value proposition, it's kind of like, you know, what we're doing is to make people feel more familiar with, you know, really good experience, you know, with, you know, giving people an pseudonymous identity. So, you know, a lot of, you know, how we think about our design is also, you know, how do we, you know, do generative art, right, to reflect someone's place in time? How do we give people a sense of security and belonging, right? Like we're kind of some thinking about, because of the station metaphor, like different cities, right? Like giving people, launching these, you know, city-based ticketing system to give them an NFT that feels familiar. So a lot of these like consumer grade, you know, experience really serves as a metaphor of like helping people understand like the kind of analogy that they're making when they're entering into Web3. It's like, you know, you're ticketing your NFT. It's really like a pass, right? It is a pass. It's an access pass for you to enter services that otherwise people have no like access to. And, you know, as a contributor, you accrue reputation by actually, you know, working on projects. And how are we presenting projects? We're thinking about, you know, bulletin, right? In the station, in the train station, you see these bulletin boards, you see these magazine racks, you see newsstand. And these are actually traditionally, you know, back in like, this is like web before, like pre-web, you know, that's how people discover jobs in yellow page. You know, that's how people discover information. So we're trying to just like, you know, revisit these kind of metaphors that are familiar to people and make them feel like, you know, this is actually more familiar to a human experience than a very technical experience, and how you kind of, you know, work, how you find interesting opportunities, how you connect with others in, you know, in the station network. It's this like, you know, familiar experience of building up your reputation in the real world as well. It just happens that we also are powered by crypto. We are like a crypto network. And there's a lot of these token mechanics that, you know, we I think by, you know, introducing these metaphors was slowly introduced to people as well.
You know, something I'm curious about, given what you're saying, a large role that Station's playing and that you're playing as a community builder is helping address problems that people have of onboarding onto complicated spaces. So you referenced the fact that we could all acknowledge there are problems in the tech industry. That's a whole other different podcast. But as an onboarder, what problems are you seeing in Web3 spaces?
I think the biggest thing is like not knowing why they are in Web3 and what they should be working on, and who they are. I think those are actually the three main things. So the first one is like, why? So I think many people are still like speculative, besides the financial, very obviously financial upside, potentially paper gains in Web3. There's some real wealth being created as well, but that's another topic. But yeah, like besides that, I think a lot of people are a little bit repulsed by the idea of like a lot of things that are happening that are super opportunistic. So actually the highest quality talent, right, like especially those who are unfamiliar with crypto, actually really don't like crypto because of the type of opportunistic kind of, you know, scams and, you know, things that are happening in this space. So there's almost like a stigma around the industry. I think recently it's been a lot better, even just in the past, I think, few months. I think NFT definitely contributed to that. And a lot of kind of celebrities, I think, adopting the technology also helped slightly with the brand. But generally, I think, you know, the why is very unclear to a lot of people. And, you know, without giving that why and that purpose and telling, as you mentioned, right, it's very obvious that you're very sensitive to narrative as an instrument, like, you know, telling the story about crypto as a way to, you know, really empower a sense of ownership that previously was not possible. Like, you know, telling the story of, you know, being able to become, you know, your basically your own agent, but at the same time, you also can feel a sense of belonging by sharing resources and coordinate resources with a group of people that you really like. So I think a lot of these narratives needs to be developed and become more mature for people to understand like why this matters in the first place. And the point two that I was making was like what to work on. I think DAOs are so new and decentralized organizations are so new, and even like the best protocols, right? Like, you know, Maker, Uniswap, and, you know, some of these, you know, protocols that have really taken off in the past year, you know, they just started also their community and DAO effort like not too long ago, probably like less than a year ago. And even SushiSwap, you know, has been around for a year. I think they're defining, to be honest, these new roles and these new opportunities. But, you know, it's super early and, you know, a lot of new roles already emerged, right? Meme artists and like treasury strategist, token architect. So all these like new titles start to emerge, but still pretty ambiguous. So for many people who come in that have no idea what's happening, they're just like, I am a marketer, or like I'm a like PR manager. Like what's going on here? Like, do I have a place here? Like the very obvious answer is yes, but there's both a demand side problem and a supply side problem, right? The supply side, which is the supply side of the job market, like their problem is they don't really know how to communicate to people that are outside of crypto. And that's actually a very common thread. And you don't know how to find them because they're on different platforms. Like one only hangs out on Twitter and Discord, and the other is like in LinkedIn and email. So they're just like different worlds already. And on the demand side, like they don't really know, like, you know, where they're needed. And there's really no way to really discover that. So I think the what is pretty difficult right now, and there's no way to define that. And actually, that's one of the problems that Station hopefully could also address as well. And the last part is like how they're going to like coordinate and how they can be compensated and be fairly compensated for the work they do. And that part, I think it's actually pretty tricky because, you know, unless there's a way to really effectively measure, you know, the type of work you do, and there's literally zero market rate right now in crypto. So a lot of these kind of numbers are somewhat arbitrary, and the hiring process is also decentralized, right? Like there needs to be a proposal, you know, being proposed in the forum, and the community member needs to vote on this proposal to really pass the proposal, and the, you know, the member gets hired. But the whole process is, you know, pretty fragmented, and the experience is just not so great. And above that, right, if you actually look into like any of these DAOs or communities, the actual people that are doing work are actually very few out of it. I think there's like 1% of like every community, you know, is actually doing the work. And it's not very encouraging for the core team members if they're not being fairly compensated. And also, you know, for the usual community member who even want to contribute, right, there's no real tools besides, I guess, a lot of people are using Notion and some of these tools that are obviously built for Web2, because just imagine a Notion doc with like 10,000 community members on it. Like no one would pay for that. And also it's just very hard to manage, right? So like even token gated like productivity tools, or, you know, token kind of determined tooling stack doesn't really exist. So I think all those above make actually like, you know, contributing in Web3 and the barrier of onboarding pretty high. But then there's, I think I'm addressing more on the labor market side. Of course, there's this other side, which is like more on the one is like the gas fee is too expensive. So the accessibility from a technical perspective, but also like the actual bad UX of like using a MetaMask. But I actually feel like, you know, given MetaMask growth in the past few months, I think they just hit like 10 million users last month, or maybe 2 months ago now. It's obvious that with the right incentive, in this case, is a lot of it's financial, that people would just learn how to do it. And when they learn how to do it, they teach their parents how to do it, they teach their, you know, friends how to do it. And it kind of grows like that. So I think on that front, I'm actually a little less worried. Although I do think that we need much more better designers and just general more well-rounded people, you know, in the space to, you know, round out that narrative. But I think that there's enough incentive and capital there to make that happen. But the former part that I just mentioned, which is like the actual barrier of contributing, like that is actually a pretty difficult technical problem and requires actually a lot of Web2 kind of product people to join and share their knowledge as well, because there are some shared knowledge here.
So I've got two last big questions that people are probably wondering. So as a person who comes from the venture space and worked in Web2 companies, you did a great job of illustrating at the start of the episode that Web3, DAO, all these different categories we're discussing, these are entirely different structures. How should someone who's thinking about starting something today think about whether they should be building a traditional company or they should be building the type of community-based structure you're discussing?
That's such a million-dollar question, like very literally. That's a great question. And I think really it really depends on the company. I do think that we're hitting a pretty pivotal moment, an inflection point for consumer internet companies. Like if you look at the most successful consumer internet company, I don't even think in the last 2-3 years, there's like even Clubhouse, right? Like I don't really know if people are still using Clubhouse. It just fizzled out pretty quickly. And you know, Paparazzi, which is another consumer internet company that, you know, got super popular for like 2 days. And then people just don't have a reason to stay. And like, I think the entire kind of VC-backed, you know, consumer fintech company that is like, you know, pretty banking and then give you a card and give you all these rewards. What that essentially is that, you know, CAC just continues to increase because people's mind share is, you know, limited. So once they get a card, they just don't really need another card. And, you know, CAC will increase inevitably. CAC is customer acquisition cost would increase inevitably as a result. But a lot of people, you know, invest in like Subway ads or, you know, Instagram ads to, you know, get customers. But, you know, when a million banks does that or, you know, tons of, you know, companies do that, it's not effective anymore. So what do? They repurpose the CAC to basically do other programming like lottery, like, you know, if you go to this restaurant, I give you cash back. It's just like innovative ways to kind of create these products. And I actually think they will be. Like some of them will probably still be successful based on like, you know, the consumer's demand. So for example, like, you know, if you're a college student and you want to save like, let's say 15% off on all your favorite restaurants. And, you know, this consumer fintech startup is like collaborating with Toast or something and like integrating their payment system and can do something fancy. I'm just like brainstorming right now, but like there might be a way to make it work. But I just think that the room for innovation is somewhat limited. Then let's say a Web3 company where, you know, you have this token mechanics in place where all your token holders are your biggest fan, because what's their incentive? The token price increase and what's like, and not fall, right? And the only way that token price doesn't fall is when everyone is holding the token, like everyone is, you know, holding on to it because there's value to holding a token. And that's why, you know, people need to build services, products, and whatever to provide to that community. Like that's what FWB is doing. Like they have to continue to push out experiences for the members to, you know, make sure that they actually think that it's worth to hold a token rather than liquidate it on Uniswap. And, you know, there's also like, you know, examples like, you know, Olympus, which was, you know, really popular, which got really popular in the past few weeks. Everyone's talking about it now. But, you know, what they innovated on is the staking mechanism where, you know, after you purchase the token, you stake it. And by staking, you get like, you know, really crazy APY. And, you know, the mechanism is it's basically a Ponzi scheme, but it's like a well-designed Ponzi scheme, because right now, at least at this moment in time, the incentive of, you know, withdrawing from the vault as a DAO, and they have innovative a design around like, you know, you can only LP as Olympus as a DAO, not as an individual LP. So you can't rug as an individual. Like you kind of like the entire DAO is basically the LP of this treasury. And like mechanisms like that, right, are like basically making the token price really, really increase. And by making the token price increase, it attracts more users and customers to come on Olympus and really figure out, oh, what is this, right? Like nothing is better CAC than seeing a token increase like a million X like in the past few days and months, and similar with Solana. I think a lot of early Solana holders or believers, you know, pumped the token very successfully. Now they are building this like really, really large ecosystem of, you know, builders that are building these projects, trying to bootstrap the economy of Solana. I think it's very similar logic. But I think the danger of that is, you know, if the kind of the token pumping, you know, scheme is the only thing that, you know, is creating this kind of artificial or short-term value, then it's definitely going to collapse. So, you know, the actual adoption, the actual, you know, value needs to be there for people to stay. That's why we need more actual builders and not just speculators in crypto, because if that doesn't catch up, like something's going to collapse. So I hope that answers the question.
No, it does. And especially the last call to arms for builders versus speculators. So the last quick question here is basically, there's a lot of rhetoric and frameworks around the role of a founder within a traditional company, Web2 or otherwise. You're once again building, organizing a community of really disparate people with an ideology that basically is putting forward the idea that top-down things aren't going to be as effective. What is your just basic advice for how people should think about taking on these differing roles?
This is actually an advice given by one of my, I guess, co-founders of Station. I think this is one of the best advice I've gotten, both personally and I think as a operator of the network, is I think the people that do best in crypto are the people that just know when to give up their ego and be really like truly humble and like literally pass all the upside to other people when it seems like it's the most unintuitive thing to do. But of course you have to do it strategically or else, you know, so you have to do it strategically. The actual underlying logic is actually the biggest business innovation or interesting, like kind of the reason why Web3 is so interesting, right, is because the founders are actually taking a lot less ownership of the network and really, really passing on those upside to the community members who are actually going to, you know, create and bootstrap the network and to, you know, basically raise the initial awareness of the network and have them, you know, build, feel like they're the owner as much as you are, which actually we genuinely believe in. So like, that's why we're so excited about what we build, because honestly, like, I think, you know, a lot of people in our network right now are, you know, former Web2 founders and, you know, people that just want to build and kind of don't want to think about fundraising, don't want to think about all these annoying stuff. And they come to our network and they build on top of our infrastructure, you know, using some of our tools, and they're still a founder, but then they don't have to deal with a lot of things that founders have to stress about because this network of people supporting them, and because talent is so interoperable that like an engineer that worked on this project can also help them out with theirs. There are a lot of shared resources and synergy there. So it's actually just like a more enjoyable experience. And they also still feel ownership because they literally is a shareholder of the network. So I think that's actually a fundamental difference. And we already see, even with Web2 companies and just organization design in general, that the more ownership you give to high quality group of people, like the better it will do, because there's no like single point of failure. And it's also more likely that innovation will happen just like more serendipitously from one of these like clusters of this bigger network rather than like a hierarchical or chart where a lot of decision-making power just accrues to the top.
Very well said, Tina, or whoever you actually are. That's the real discovery today. And a key detail that everyone should note, I did not pronounce Tina's last name properly. So every single thing you're hearing about her name-wise is completely incorrect, accidental, technical pseudonymity. Tina, is there anything that you would like to call out beyond sending everyone to go check out Station House, especially if they're curious about learning more?
Yeah. So Station's website is a little outdated because we've been busy building, so haven't really updated our presence. But definitely, I mean, we have a Twitter account. But
oh, quick thing. Yeah. Their website, everyone, is so cool. It's totally, whether or not it's updated, it's just a fun website to go check out.
Yeah.
Just a quick note as an outsider who just covers your space more from a media adjacent perspective. I think something that's so impressed me about all of you Web3 people, not saying that pejoratively, is you're all just very cool. very like genuinely, like very, it's a very, I'm waiting for someone to write this piece. It's not going to be written for a while, but I'm just blown away how cool Web3 people are versus the very obvious point that let's just say Web2 founders, employers are not cool. I did an episode of Cooper Turley, and he had this turtleneck, and he had this gold chain and a hat, and your website is vibey. I'm actually genuinely curious what is going on there. Like, what is it about these communities that encourages people to actually prize aesthetics versus the more, hey, it's 2011 and we look like crap, but that's actually cool in of itself dynamic. But yeah, just something that I just keep noticing whenever I talk to any of you.
That's really kind. Yeah, I feel like it's just like attracts really quirky creative people that don't like to follow rules. Because the entire Web3 is a little bit like, at least right now, which is I think similar with early internet too, a little bit like rebellious, like unapologetic, and, you know, like have this counterculture vibes. So maybe that is why. Yeah.
Rebelling against the all birds, technical pants and generic t-shirt. Yeah. Look. different forms. Thank you so much, Gina. Thanks for giving me a soapbox for my last bit. Thanks for joining the show.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us in the Deep End. If you enjoyed your stay, give us a review on Apple Podcasts and share this episode with your friends and colleagues to help grow the show with us. We've also got show notes and more episodes available at ideas.beyonddeck.com. See you next time.